Hey everybody, this is Chuck Marone with Strong Towns. Welcome back to the Strong Towns podcast. I think last week when I recorded this, I had no voice. Wow, did I limp across the finish line on the Strong America Tour. We had some great events, final events here in Minnesota last week. I was in Grand Rapids, did an event with KXE, the local radio station up there, which I'm a member and a contributor. I also did a presentation in Duluth, which was awesome. We packed the place and lots of exciting things going on in Duluth. And then I was down at the University of Minnesota for the last event of the year, where I went to undergrad school, where I went to graduate school. I actually gave the presentation in a room right next to where I had fluid dynamics as an undergrad. And so that was awesome. But I spent the next 2 days in bed, pretty much. I had a horrible cold and had lost my voice and was at the very, very kind of end of things. So limped across the finish line, have a couple of days of baking cookies and kind of getting my mind mentally centered again and feel a lot better, ready to hit kind of this last week and then, take some time off. We do that here at Strong Towns. I kind of recognize early on, like a decade ago early on, that nobody really reads our stuff, in the couple of weeks around, the end of the year. And if they do, my mindset is you shouldn't be. Like, this is not the period of time you should be digging deeply into Strong Towns. Go ahead. That's fine if you really, really must. But this is really the time for everybody to kind of slow down, think about life a little bit. That kind of thing. And so I just decided we're not going to publish. We're not going to do anything. So we shut down our social stream. We shut down our site. We just kind of go dark. And, we still do some work. I mean, we're kind of use that period of time to get caught up on some things. But I've always used it at the end of the year as just this reflective time, this time to sit down and I think recenter yourself and be grateful. Really more than anything. And this year I'm extremely grateful. Today is actually my 24th wedding anniversary. My wife and I got married on December 16th, 1995. She graduated from college like the week before. Some people, when they find out it's their 24 year wedding anniversary, said, wow, you're older than I thought you were. No, we just got married really, really young. My wife and I started dating in junior high, actually, and dated through college and high school and college, which is cool. It's not that kind of story we like to talk about now, where we have a 15-year-old and 12-year-old girls. Like, you can wait till you're 35. But we did. So today is my 24th. My wife and I's 24th year wedding anniversary. And I was just thinking about it today as I'm sitting down to do this. We've had I don't want to say a hard time here at Strong Towns, but we've had a couple things not go our way here at the end of the year. I don't need to get into them. Created a little bit more chaos and anxiety than I like to have in December. On top of that, like, my basement flooded while we were in California. It's still kind of a chaotic mess. I did make a trip to the landfill today and got rid of all the carpets and the rugs that I had drug outside and drug them out so that they could freeze. That was not pleasant. My wife had a couple of significant family members, of course, who's not significant in a family, but, immediate family members, that passed away in the last 2 months, that was a big impact for her and for me as well. But I know for her, it was a difficult time. And, just having teenage girls, for those of you out there that have gone through that, what an intense experience, especially an intense experience when, one of the family members, one of the adults in the family is not around. I can't imagine. And I've always had respect for people who find themselves in a situation where they're raising kids, with a single adult in the house. Quite frankly, it's a, I don't know how you would ever do that. I watch my wife when I'm gone, and it's tough. I mean, it is difficult. It is hard. And the amount that I was on the road, and we did 55 talks in 2.5 months, an intense period of time. And it was exhausting for me. And then I would get home and I'd be like, oh, I'm so tired. I'm just worn out. I just need to rest. And then I would look at my wife, I'd look at my family, and I'd be like, oh, it's nothing. You know, you guys have sacrificed more than I have. So I'm sitting here at the end of the year, and more than anything else, I'm getting my mind in that gratitude frame. I'm immensely gratitude. What? It's getting a little late at night. I am immensely grateful, obviously, for my family and for everything they've done. To help, you know, make, and Griff, you can hear him in the background here, Gryffindor. Yes, I'm grateful for you too, buddy. Thanks for bringing me this toy to play with. We'll do that in a few minutes here. All right. Just chill, pal. I'm immensely grateful. But I'm also grateful for, you know, the team we have at Strongtowns, everything that they did to make the book launch and the book tour successful. Everything they've done to keep the content stream going in my absence, everything they've done to reach out to new people. This podcast itself, even though we've been broadcasting a little bit irregularly, we're hitting all-time records this year for the number of people that have downloaded this podcast. The number of people that have been on our website is up in a big way. Just every number is going up. And I'm just immensely grateful for the team that has helped make this happen. I'm going to keep going because I'm immensely grateful for all those members, the almost 3,000 members of Strongtowns, people giving us $5 a month, $10 a month. We ran into a little, one of these like collection of sucker punches we've gotten in the last couple of weeks here is we ran into this financial thing, and I won't go into it. It's not something we need to discuss at length, but basically, we were awarded a rather large, especially for us, amount of money, and had it kind of taken away or rescinded upon for no real fault of our own. It was a gut punch, especially now towards the end of the year, and we let that be known to a group of members, a group of people who have been very active supporters of us, and they're stepping up and coming through and picking up the slack. And it is amazing to be part of a movement where people will do that. I can't express the depth of gratitude that I have for all of you and everything you've done to make this possible. It's astounding to me. I'm grateful for the couple million audience members we have. Some of you are casual. You've shown up once and never come back. But many of you come back again and again and again, and not only come back and you know, read and listen to and watch our content, but have gone the next step and shared it with somebody else, told someone else about it. You know, shared that with someone in your own way, in your own words. Nothing you can do really will do more. If everyone who just listened to this podcast went out and shared Strongtowns ideas with someone else, we would be in an amazing place. So thank you. Thank you for that. Thank you for all that you've done. And I'm just immensely grateful for this opportunity. I mean, I don't think I say this enough. Strongtowns started as me writing a blog. And I tell this story sometimes when I'm speaking in front of audiences. You know, there was a big element of therapy here with this. You know, 2008 was, I sometimes call it my fanatic year. You know, I was deep into what would become Strongtowns, what would become the Strongtowns conversation. I've been working for years running my own engineering and planning firm, and I was just at kind of like the fanatic stage. Winston Churchill describes a fanatic as someone who can't change their mind and won't change the subject. And I kind of got into that phase. You know, I'd gone through the couple years of looking at data and looking at numbers and trying to figure out what was going on. And I was at the, you know, Chicken Little, like the sky is falling. Like, what are we doing? This is nuts. And you juxtapose that with the 2008 election, which I'm just going to tell you at the time seemed insane. You know, you got banks failing, you got gas prices over $4 a gallon. You've got huge bailouts of Congress. This was an insane election campaign. I know it looks quaint now. I know it looks quaint. At the time, it was insane. And I really got to the point in my own personal life where, you know, either the world was crazy or I was crazy. And quite frankly, I was open to either. Like I genuinely didn't know. And so when I sat down and started to write, it was partially trying to share this idea, this set of ideas with other people, but it was also part of a way to like calm my mind, you know, like I'm going to discipline myself to sit down and write this stuff. I think I got a book in here ultimately. I don't know. I mean, maybe these ideas aren't worthy. I'm going to write them up. I'm going to share them with people. And, you know, I'm going to figure out what is really happening. That was a deeply therapeutic, and I would say, you know, to say that altered my life would be an understatement. It altered everything about my life, because you, and I say this in a small you and then grew to this enormous you stepped up and said, hey, you're not crazy. And although you're not crazy, you've got some ideas that are worthy. I can't think of, you know, I could sit here for the next hour and list all the people who encouraged me along the way. From the two people that helped me found this thing, Ben Olson and John Commerce. John sat down and said, Chuck, you need to start a nonprofit. You know, we need to do this. Like, this needs to happen. These ideas are too important. I can't tell you how many people in my life have been like that to me. Just said, hey, take the next step. Hey, keep going. Even in the last week, as we've kind of faced this, you know, challenge after challenge after challenge, I've had a number of people call me up and say, hey, hang in there, man. You got this. You're doing it. This matters. So I am sitting here tonight with Gryffindor, the dog, at my feet, my family, you know, upstairs sleeping, all secure and happy. 24 years married, a full belly, a warm house. You know, it's cold outside, and in Minnesota here, you get bundled up when you go out, but you come in and you appreciate the heat and the warmth. I'm sitting here, and the main emotion I have is just gratitude. It's just gratitude. And I just want to say at the end of the year, thank you. Thank you for all you've done to help us share this message. Thank you for all you've done for me to make that possible. And let's take a couple of weeks here and just reflect on life and where we're at. And let's come back in 2020 and hit this really hard. I'm going to leave you today with a breakout session we had in Southern California. I found this fascinating. California has this very strange set of laws that they've dealt with over time that they just call redevelopment. And I'm going to interpolate for people who are not in California. Take eminent domain and tax increment financing and crossbreed it with basically like an independent agency that has its own capacity to borrow money. And you have California redevelopment agencies. It's not hard for me to see why these things are an absolute disaster and why they've done all kinds of damage. They wrap every bad incentive into one kind of package. Yet in the dysfunction that is California, and California is like the epicenter of many things, government dysfunction being one of them. In the dysfunction that is California local government, there might just be a role for redevelopment agencies. And I've been fascinated to hear the argument presented in what I think is its best form. You know, not as a straw man, but as an actually authentic argument. We were able to have two people that I found to be very, very intelligent and very thoughtful, come and speak at the Southern California Gathering about redevelopment in favor of redevelopment, or at least disposed to think that there's a role for it, albeit one that would include some reform and some changes, is a guy named Mike Madrid. I didn't know Mike before this. I got to meet him through this process. He's an expert in many ways. He's very well connected in Sacramento. He's been a press secretary for at the California Assembly. He now is an advisor to the California Latino Economic Institute, board of directors of the American Association of Political Consultants, and he teaches and lectures on race, class, and partisanship at the University of Southern California. Mike was a delight. I was able to have dinner with him and immediately found a connection just in the way his mind kind of approached things. I like this guy a lot. The guy who was, we asked to come and speak, who was critical of redevelopment agencies, is a guy named Stephen Greenhut. He wrote a piece on our site that we ran running up to the Southern California gathering. And it was, to say it was controversial would be, you know, minimizing it. He raised the ire of a lot of people in California who had dealt with the rental housing, the rent control issue that California just recently passed. I found Stephen to be very engaging. Obviously he courts controversy. I mean, this is not a guy who backs down from it. But also a guy who needs to be taken seriously. I mean, he has a lot of thoughtful ideas. Like I said, I'm kind of predisposed to be sympathetic to his point of view on this one. And as someone sitting opposite of Mike Madrid, which I found out later, the two are friends, the two get along and hang out. You're going to hear them going back and forth, having two very, very different, you know, viewpoints here. The contrast is very sharp. Stephen is the Western Regional Director of the R Street Institute. He's based in Sacramento. He talked about his time with the newspaper. He writes a lot of op-eds and policy studies. He's well-read, well-spoken, and writes frequently and is widely read. And so let me, as an end-of-the-year kind of treat, give you what I thought was a very stimulating debate and conversation from the Southern California gathering. You're going to hear myself, you're going to hear Mike Madrid, and you're going to hear Stephen Greenhut. And I'm going to go throw some toys around for Griff, who's coming here now with like his third toy. Like, is this one okay? Can we play with this one? He brought me, this is the third toy he's brought me while I'm recording this. Going, you didn't like those first two. Maybe you like this one. How about it? How about it? So I'm going to go do that. Merry Christmas, everyone. I celebrate Christmas, so I'm going to say Merry Christmas. Whatever you celebrate, whatever your traditions are, I just wish you peace and goodwill and happy end of the year and a beautiful beginning of 2020. We'll see you back in January. Take care.
One's property always is in peril. So I covered a theme park proposal in Garden Grove. So Garden Grove always had Anaheim envy. So they're just down the road from Anaheim. And Anaheim is the happiest place on earth. They have the Disneyland, and Garden Grove wanted, you know, they want that revenue. So you'll see up and down, up in, what is it? I forget which street it's on now. I haven't lived here for a while. Just a bunch of subsidized hotels. Well, they were going to take this big working class neighborhood. It's just a very nice middle class neighborhood of 60s tract houses, and turn it into, demolish them, and turn it into a theme park on spec. So that's the kind of thing that redevelopment allows. Now that may be on the extreme, but I've seen all sorts of things like this thanks to redevelopment. Because if you give government power, they're going to use whatever powers at their ready. So they use that. So I had a friend who he got this. This wasn't in California, but this was in Des Moines, and he had a downtown building, and he picks up the Des Moines Register. And he goes, wow, there's this new office building going, and that looks close to where I work. Oh, that's right on top of where I work. And that's the kind of thing that happens. And he had made plans. He bought the building next door, paid too much for it because it was something he needed for the future growth of his building. He now no longer had future growth, and he was not offered a lot of money for the building. So I've seen it many times of redevelopment agencies shortchanging the people whose properties they're taking, forcing them, people who often don't have the wherewithal, forcing them to go to attorneys and try to get a better payout. It's really unfair. So companies use, the savvy companies, the kind of companies, I think, that we looked at earlier, the ones that are specializing in those ugly, or I don't know if they're ugly, but they're look-alike housing blocks with the Quiznos on the bottom, they go to cities and they use the cities as land clearing agencies to help them get prime property on the cheap. They do something called growth capture. I've seen this before. Let's say I invested in a property 20 years ago and in kind of a iffy neighborhood, and now it's starting to get better, thanks to market forces. And then, you know, the redevelopers come in and swoop in and they grab it just as it's about to boom, and they take all the, you know, they get to benefit from what you've invested in over the years. And, you know, we just walked around Santa Ana, which is really nice, a downtown. I invite everyone to go walk around downtown Anaheim. That's kind of a trick question, because there is no downtown Anaheim. It used to be nicer than this. But in the 70s, the redevelopment agency bulldozed the whole thing. And it's only in recent years that we see new plans, new things, but it'll never be the same, because you give government power of eminent domain, that's what redevelopment does, and central planning authority, and they're gonna use it. And it's not gonna create incremental change, it's you know, top-down change. So Santa Ana, you can see all the vacant lots that the redevelopment agency has assembled, just sitting there. The Register's done quite a few stories. Governments are not the best stewards of property, and you can find that anywhere. In what world do central planners know what's best? And that's what redevelopment is, it's central planning. Formed in 1940s as urban renewal agencies, quickly morphed into a tax grab. Part of that's because of Prop 13 and some other things, but I disagree with you about Prop 13, but that's a different debate. But then the city planners, they create a project area. So right around Howard, I'm gonna call that area blighted, the two chairs around Howard.
Yeah.
And I've never seen, I get a consultant, gets a lot of money to do a blight report. I've never seen a blight report come out that hasn't found blight. In fact, Mammoth Lake was blighted. Why? Because it was excessively urbanized. I don't know if you've all been to Mammoth Lakes. Diamond Bar, because of chipping paint. Those were two rare cases where the court overturned the blight finding. Very few times that they're ever overturned. And then you grab the tax increment financing. That's the growth in the property taxes. And that pays back the enormous amount of debt that gets floated. And what the cities want is the sales tax dollars, because those are discretionary dollars. So they use it instead of fixing up old neighborhoods. Sometimes they do, but mostly they build auto malls and big box stores, which bring in the sales tax revenue. Now, the Kelo decision, you're probably all familiar with, in 2005, allowed this. They allowed cities to use eminent domain for public benefit rather than public use. Big difference. Public use, okay, I'm gonna build a courthouse or a highway owned by the public. You know, you may take issue with the particular project, but it is a public use. Public benefit is anybody who pays a lot more taxes than me provides a public benefit. So, you know, giving Donald Trump an old lady's house for a limo parking lot in Atlantic City is a public benefit, because his casino pays higher taxes than her house. And Sandra Day O'Connor had a memorable dissent in the case. Today, the court abandons this long-held basic limitation on government power. Under the banner of economic development, all private property is now vulnerable to being taken and transferred to another private owner, so long as it might be upgraded, i.e. given to an owner who will use it in a way the legislature deems more beneficial to the public in the process. And that's exactly what redevelopment is all about. So California never seriously reformed its eminent domain laws. So if our redevelopment agencies come back, these kind of abuses will multiply. Now, redevelopment agencies fiscalized land use. I reported on a church that had a property up in Cyprus, and they were gonna build a church. And the city officials realized, oh my gosh, this is like the last good retail parcel we have left in, you know, landlocked Cyprus. So they tried using eminent domain to take it so that they could give it to Costco. And I was at some of the council discussions where the city council members said, well, we have enough churches in Cyprus already. So I guess one church is as good as another to a city official. So redevelopment agencies, under using them, city officials don't see themselves as public servants, but as people trying to maximize tax revenue on each parcel. So yes, redevelopment agencies provided 20% of their funds to affordable housing, but they also created this enormous disincentive for cities to build housing. And you know, because they always preferred retail, where retail always pays a lot more than housing. So I don't believe we can build our way out of the housing mess through subsidized projects, a point Jerry Brown repeatedly made. But I think the negative side of this was much worse than whatever positive came from the redevelopment. So Brown eliminated them. They were consuming 13% of the budget. He did it for the wrong reason, but I don't care. If you do the right thing for the wrong reason, it's fine with me. He just wanted more money for other uses. These agencies, they spent the money frivolously. In Sacramento, what was it, $5.8 million in subsidies for a mermaid bar, just a sleazy bar where women dressed as mermaids float around in a fish tank and a pizza joint. And the one street in downtown Sacramento that never, ever, ever seems to improve is K Street. It is a little bit now, but for years it hasn't been improving, and that's the one street that redevelopment agencies of the city control. They don't allow the market to happen. All sorts of ludicrous proposals, because central planners don't always have the best ideas. So Garden Grove was going to do a museum to King Hussein of Jordan. Anyway, it reminds me of Music Man when people come to River City and sell a bill of goods to city officials. So what, I have about a minute or two?
You're done, but you can wrap up.
Okay, yeah, let me just wrap up. And we'll get into some of these other things that I was going to talk about in the discussion. But I just want to finish with a Jane Jacobs quote, since I started with her. She said, "There is a quality even meaner than outright ugliness or disorder, and this meaner quality is the dishonest mask of pretended order, achieved by ignoring or suppressing the real order that is struggling to exist and to be served." And I think that's what redevelopment does. So, okay.
Thank you.
Should I...
Go ahead and sit down. Thank you. Very good. Now I would like to have Mike Madrid with Grassroots Lab come up. Mike was part of our dinner as well, and I got a lot out of that conversation last night. You're going to hear an opposite point of view about redevelopment. That's exactly what we're trying to create. So please, come on up, Mike. Thank you.
Thank you. Thank you all for having me. This is fantastic. It's great to be involved with an organization like this. I've spent about 15, 20 years of my career working with local governments, most recently with the League of California Cities, tackling some of these issues very specific to redevelopment type of issues. Redevelopment, it's a fascinating idea. It's a fascinating concept. And it's really, I think, kind of the one policy area that I have seen engage most of the emotions that amongst Californians and probably all Americans that I wish most other local government policy issues that we work on and tackle could focus. One of my main roles was as a senior advisor to the California Redevelopment Association. During this time of extraordinary budget constraints in California during the last downturn of the recession. And so for those of you who may not be Californians, I do want to make this really clear. The fight over redevelopment, 99% of this had nothing to do with anything that Steve just spoke about, although those are very legitimate concerns, we'll talk about those. It had everything to do with the state taking the money for its own purposes in this continuing battle between the state and local relationship in California. Moreover, there isn't a single thing that Steve mentioned that cannot be reformed or limited or removed entirely from redevelopment as the state continues discussions on bringing redevelopment back. And let me make this very clear before we start the discussion. Redevelopment will come back in California. It will probably come back this year. It will probably be under a different name, but the ability to use tax increment financing is far too powerful a tool to not use to ameliorate many of the social problems that have been created because of its removal. For example, in March of 2012, the month when we started to unravel, redevelopment associations and cities were forced to sell off their properties to provide those monies to the state's public employee unions, 56% of Californians could afford a median family home. Today, only 28%, just 5 years later, less than half of those that could purchase a medium family home in California are now available and able to do that. Now, did the elimination of redevelopment cause all of that? No. But was it a significant part of that problem? There's no question about it. Redevelopment was pumping $1 billion a year into affordable housing with just a 20% set aside. $1 billion a year. Most estimates, even the most conservative, would suggest that it would be over $2 billion a year now. $2 billion a year provides a lot of housing, even under some of the scary scenarios that you looked at from the previous speaker on housing that Daniel, I think, was speaking about. So when you focus and reorient tax increment financing to meet a specific purpose, especially when there is a crisis, and I don't care where you're at on the political spectrum, right, left, center, middle, bottom, down, wherever, California is experiencing an extraordinary housing crisis. To be able to appropriate all of that money, remove the blight findings. You can even remove eminent domain usage for redevelopment purposes, because a lot of agencies in California did. There's a million ways to mitigate all of the abuse problems, and many of them did exist, that Stephen was talking about, and still accomplish positive results for your community. It's, again, far too powerful a tool to be used, to not be using to address specific policy purposes. And for affordable housing, housing generally, but housing, affordable housing specifically, the state will have no choice but to have this be one of its tools in its arsenal. Those discussions are ongoing. They have been going for a number of years. There have been efforts to bring it back, not only in limited scope and form, but I would suggest and I would predict that in this upcoming legislative session, you will see a much more significant and enhanced use for tax increment financing, specifically as it relates to affordable housing, probably affordable housing specifically. So with that, I don't want to go on too long because I think we're probably going to have a lot of questions on this, and there's certainly going to be a lot of give and take between Stephen and I. Let me go ahead and wrap up there.
You've got 5 minutes left, but you take whatever you want.
Well, look, let me clarify too. My area of expertise in this is working in the area of public opinion as it relates to a whole range of issues that local governments deal with, but specifically on things like eminent domain and on redevelopment purposes and what people are looking for in their communities. There is no question that there was a whole host and range of abuses that came as a result of many years of inattention to what cities were doing in pushing the line, going way beyond the line and what they should have been using tax increment financing for, establishing redevelopment agencies for. But there's also a whole litany of successes that California can speak to as well, including the area that we are in now. And most of the urban core, most of the urban centers that are now so attractive to so many people that have seen this new influx of new people into our state are largely benefiting from the investments that were made over the past 10, 15, 20 years. And to suggest that markets alone would solve that problem, I think is, while as a good, strong conservative and a huge believer in markets, I'm also a Californian who's lived here for almost half a century now, to see some of our downtowns that were dilapidated for many, many decades because the market was not working, because it was not incentivizing capital, is a stronger statement, a much stronger testament to that problem. Curiously, and I am going to wrap up on this, I also do have a very unique experience with this. Steve and I were talking about this on the plane. Has anybody here had any property seized through eminent domain? By a show of hands, let me take a look around. One, two, three. I have had property seized through eminent domain, and I will tell you that a lot of the process is extraordinarily uncomfortable. That's a good way, that's a very politic way of saying it sucks, okay? And a lot of the reforms and safeguards that were put in to protect property owners were not and have not been over the years been implemented or strengthened or protected. And again, the resolution for that is legislative, okay? There are remedies to all of this, including eliminating the use of eminent domain. There were dozens of redevelopment agencies that did not allow the use of eminent domain. And tax increment financing can still work in those instances. So it's very important that when we go through this discussion, we really keep an eye on the ball when we're talking about this tool, as was pointed out. This is a tool. Why you would remove a tool from your tool chest when you're trying to make policies related to planning for ideological purposes is just silliness, okay? You can reform it, you can change it, you can dramatically limit it, but to remove that ability to utilize such a powerful tool just doesn't make sense. California, by the way, incidentally, is one of two states in the union that does not have tax increment financing at this point. Again, like I said, by the end of next year, I think that will probably no longer be the state, the situation. Us in Arizona, two states with two very different needs in terms of the way that they grow and develop, are the only states in the union that do not have some sort of redevelopment power for local governments. So I'm going to go ahead and end right there. We'll go ahead and jump.
Can you explain how a TIF works, just for the benefit of
everybody? Oh, let's
do. Yeah, or do you want to walk through? Why don't you walk through the TIF process?
Let's sit down and we'll answer that question first.
Okay.
Yeah. Thank you, Mike. You can take either one.
You're going to sit in the middle as a moderate.
In the middle. Let me give you a microphone. Let's talk about how TIF works. Do one of you want to take that, or you want me to do that?
Why don't you take that? Well, unless Steve, you want to talk about it.
It doesn't matter to me, however.
Let me give you the way it works in. These are weird chairs.
Oh, yeah.
Let me give you the way it works in Minnesota, and then you can update it for California. Tax increment financing is kind of predicated on blight. Or on, in Minnesota, we have this strange but-for argument. But-for a tax subsidy, this development that is being proposed would not happen. And once you meet that test, essentially what the transaction results in is, right now, the value of the property and the tax, let's say the taxes paid on the property is here. We go in and redevelop, and the taxes that would be paid after that redevelopment are here. There's an increment of tax increase. That increment is then captured and used to essentially make that project happen.
Or pay off the bonds.
Pay off the debt. Sometimes it's used to pay public infrastructure. Sometimes it's given right back to the developer as a like an incentive payment. But basically you're talking about this development wouldn't happen but for this incentive. And then the development happens, and then the incentive is part of that package. Is that
right? You create a project area here. This is blighted, and then we find blight, and then the future tax increment goes to the city, and that money pays off the bonds. But what the cities usually want are the sales tax revenue, because that's discretionary money.
Right. I want to start where there seems to be consensus, and there seems to be consensus around the idea that there were abuses of redevelopment. So
for sure.
And so I think the question then becomes, I want to see if there's another consensus here on the other end, that there is a need here. There is an underlying problem of neighborhoods going into blight, going into decline, and not really having a mechanism at local government's disposal to deal with that. And I think you probably agree with that.
I would largely agree with it, but not entirely.
Please go for it.
And let me say this. The finding of blight really was a concept that came out of the 1940s with the first urban renewal projects. The problem with the finding of blight is kind of in the eye of the beholder. And Stephen's got, I could go off with dozens of examples where cities out in the desert would declare desertscape blighted so they could build a golf course. Clearly not an intended use for what we're trying to accomplish. But the real power is not based on blight. You can bring back redevelopment without a finding of blight. That has just been its historical use. You can use that for something more specific to its time. For example, housing. California has an extraordinary housing problem. You can dedicate tax increment or TIF towards meeting certain housing or housing objective goals and allow cities to have this tool at its disposal to accomplish those ends. So I'm not convinced that we need to simply have a finding of blight in order to use tax increment financing. That's historically been what we've used it for. But there is no question that we cannot simply wait decades and decades and frankly have property owners, numerous property owners, who have abused the ability to come in and leverage this city. by holding parcels in its inner core hostage, by running those properties into the ground against the public's benefit in order to leverage more dollars from payouts from the city.
I've got a follow-up. I want to ask first on this question I asked. Yeah. Are there other mechanisms at, let's say, municipalities, local communities' disposal to allow them to get properties, in a sense, and I'm going to broaden it to not blight, but unstuck?
Well, yeah, it's called letting people do stuff.
Okay.
I mean, I've fixed up properties myself in my very small way. I own just a handful of properties in older cities. Right. And you know how hard it is. Cities are not your friend. And so much would happen. Nobody's going to sit on a vacant lot if the area's booming. The problem isn't that there's not enough centralized government power. That's what redevelopment gives people. And we know there's almost like this childlike faith in government that if you give these earnest officials.
But what about the, and this is kind of why, because I wanted to get this from you. Yeah. This is why I started today with the land value tax and the property tax. It's clear that part of what California has created is an incentive structure from a tax standpoint that encourages stagnation. People buying properties, holding on to them, not thickening the neighborhood up, converting to duplexes, adding things. You kind of reward that.
Well, if you want to talk, we could do, we don't have enough time in the world to do a Prop 13 session.
Right.
But there's no question Prop 13 caused some distortions. But you folks are talking often about getting rid of Prop 13. And when I hear that, that means a massive increase in the one tax in the state that's reasonable, right? We're in the middle of the road on our taxes on Prop 13. It has all sorts of problems. And we were talking, I think Matt Holder and I were talking about, if there were people who had some tweaks to Prop 13, and we didn't believe that there was just the goal to get rid of it just so that we could get all this money to provide to public employee unions. I mean, look at the pension mess in this state. Look how our government has spent the money it's been given, and it's not a pretty sight. But I want to address a point. I mean, back on, because the Prop 13 debate is long and fruitless. But the point you made that redevelopment could be fixed if we did it this way, this way, this way. Well, it could be. The pension system could be fixed in California. Anything could be fixed, but it's not going to. Jim Beal's bill this year, what was it, SB5? SB5. He wasn't even going to put in reforms to eminent domain.
I'm interested in the idea of reforming it. What you said a minute ago made me think. When you broaden it from blight to basically properties that are stuck, is part of the vision that maybe you or others have for redevelopment is we have a single family neighborhood.
Sorry about that.
It's okay. Mine does it sometimes too. We have a single family neighborhood. Boy, we really need more density. It'd be great if we had 5-story condo units through here because we could do a bunch of them with affordable. We can meet a bunch of public policy objectives.
That's the Wiener bill. That's not the redevelopment.
No, but so through tax increment financing, through some type of redevelopment, we're going to acquire these 4 blocks and then redevelop them. Is that a valid use of redevelopment? I can see the public policy connection.
It could be. And again, I don't want to oversimplify it, but let me say this, and I think you really characterized this early from the outset. California, and the Prop 13 discussion is primary. It's central here. Because of Prop 13, California has developed a whole maze, this kind of Rube Goldberg contraption of tax policy in a battle between the state and local relationship, this battle between mandates coming from the state and incentives for the cities and local governments to actually do something. And the way that you characterize it is perfect. We are continually looking for the next way to overlay the new layer of public policy scheme to fix the underlying issues because it's become so impossible to unravel now. So the question becomes, could that possibly be an incentive and a purpose? The short answer is yes. Obviously, it would require a ton of safeguards in the policy to make sure that cities aren't just wholesale going out and wiping out massive parcels just because that's what it's decided to do. But there really is no other way to incentivize cities to bring the housing online that we need. And it is also undeniable, as a Prop 13 supporter, that Prop 13 created that situation. I've been working on the fiscalization of land use issue for 25 years. Today is the first time I have ever heard somebody say that was a product of redevelopment associations. It's a direct result of capping property taxes under Prop 13. Property tax does not pay for housing. It does not pay for housing in California. You have to, as a local government, chase sales tax, which means it distorts land use decisions to go after retail instead of building housing. That's the underlying problem.
Here's my follow-up question for you. What I hear being said from the people who are kind of on the pro-redevelopment side or the pro-having this tax subsidy side is that there's something fundamentally broken about the market feedback mechanism here in the state. You're not getting, you have homeless encampments, prices are ridiculously high, you're not getting the supply and demand. And I hear the very libertarian YIMBY argument be, well, just like, make it easier to build more units. Well, but haven't you done that for decades and decades?
No, we haven't. I mean, we've been piling on regulation after regulation. I think this is something Mike and I agree on. We make it extremely difficult that I don't want to take blame for it. Our government makes it extremely difficult to build anything. In San Diego County, when I did the research when I was down there working for the Union Tribune, 40% of the cost of a brand new house, which the average cost is around $800,000, goes to government fees. And that doesn't even count the inflated cost of the land underneath it. And I saw, you know, some of the presentations earlier. It's fascinating how we have hermetically sealed these neighborhoods. We don't let things happen. But yes, we need to build more. We need to let people build more. It's not we need to build more. We need to allow people to build things. And I've seen it, as I had mentioned, just as a really tiny player who tries to fix something up on my own. The only people who, and this is something that redevelopment reinforces, the only people who get to play in the game are the wealthy developers who specialize and who buy off the city councils. I'm not suggesting anything illegal. I'm just, they're the ones who get selected for these projects, and people who make a difference. And that's one of the things I like about strong towns and the things you point out is it's incremental. It makes a difference if I can build a fourplex or a triplex, if a number of people in the neighborhood I live in are allowed to do these things. The redevelopment approach is we centralize decisions in City Hall. And some of these people, I've been covering government for years as a reporter, and some of these people aren't the brightest tools in the shed. And they're gonna make these development decisions, and they have all these powers to drive people off their property, and they're gonna give it all to these big developers who come top down. That's the problem.
So this is my related question to you. It does seem like right now, local government, even in a place like Santa Ana, which I think is great, is oriented up towards Sacramento, towards DC, towards the muni bond market, towards the large capital developers, instead of being oriented down towards its residents and the actual needs of people. How does redevelopment, or how could redevelopment, if it's reimagined how could it make that more responsive to people in the community? Because it seems like that there is a disconnect there. Like I can drive out a whole neighborhood of people,
yeah,
and I can satisfy the advocates by putting a few affordable units in, but really what I'm doing is bringing in the Quiznos and the big players with the big capital.
Yeah.
How do we make it more accountable?
I think you can do that through the normal processes that we try to do with local governments generally, which is develop those guidelines for each redevelopment agencies at the local level, including set aside for certain developers of a certain size and scope. There is a role. I would have loved to have participated in the development project when my property was seized. I was not able to.
Would be under redevelopment.
No, that's not true. What I'm saying is there is a remedy for that. That's what you're not accepting and you're not listening to. There's absolutely a way to remedy that, and it can be at the local level. I will tell you this, though. I was not, nor are you, capable of building something that is a 450-unit complex. Right. That doesn't mean you can't participate in it financially. But that also means that you should probably bring somebody who's done that and has that expertise before. One. Two, I think that we also have to do a lot more in terms of social equity. because the elimination of redevelopment has also led to a distortion in the market that is making us a more segregated racially and class-based society in California. That has dangerous social impacts. And when we can use the power of markets and the power of capital to ameliorate some of those equities, I think we end up as a better state.
Well, you know, I'd like to address that point redevelopment agencies, minorities were targeted heavily. And, you know,
there's a history in urban renewal.
And urban renewal, I mean, Mindy Fullilove wrote a book, Root Shock, about how urban renewal, essentially redevelopment projects, unrooted the African American community. And what happens is it benefits, you know, the wealthy people. It's there's a reason they're you know, urban renewal was called Negro removal, right, back in the 60s. So the idea that not giving government the amount of power that it's had to pick and choose winners and losers and subsidize companies like Costco is going to somehow hurt inner city communities. I don't agree with that. I agree with allowing people to live their own lives, reducing the barriers.
I'm going to have a question for you on if this gets approved and you're in the room, what's the reform you want? But hang on to that for a second, because I want to go back to you and ask. There's this trade-off, and Daniel brought it up today, and I'm not sure where you're at, and we're kind of dancing around this, but the idea of incremental being not slow, but built by many hands.
Yeah.
And one thing that redevelopment seems to me to have that is a little bit pernicious is that you do tend to get the one big hand, yeah, as opposed to the many little hands. Is that something that you see as a problem, and is that something that you think can be dealt with through a reform process?
I think it's a very serious problem for exactly the reasons that Stephen was talking about, and I don't think that it's healthy for communities. I also believe that there are numerous ways where we can make sure that those communities that are being removed, especially in a state as segregated as California is, and we don't think about that a lot, but it is among the most segregated states in the country, can have some ownership stake in the products and the processes that are developed. How that specifically looks, I don't know, but what I do know the answer in terms of the processes is having a local process developed by local communities with local control for local benefit by local redevelopment agencies is the answer, community by community.
Yeah, but then you get into the Garden Grove. So there's so many of them that they're not going to reform. You might get a few. I've seen a few, but I've also seen, like Brea, they knocked down their downtown. Anaheim knocked down its downtown. And then people, instead of just living their lives and investing in their properties, are busy fighting political battles, an endless political battle over which local communities are going to protect their property rights and which are not. Now, you were asking what reform would
happen. So let me phrase the question like this. I do sense, and I think that you're right. You know this better than I do because of what your job is. But I do get the inclination that at some point this will pass as a tool again.
For sure.
There will be, you know, this is allowed with subpart A, B, C, D, and E qualifier. You're in the room. You're watching this happen. You can't stop it. But you can put your amendment to it on, say, here's the reform I want. What would be a reform that wouldn't make this palatable for you and make it like work and perfect, but would make it better to where it would be less egregious if implemented?
Well, first, we saw SB 5 actually made it to the governor's desk. It got through both houses, right, and it had no protections whatsoever for property owners. It didn't. I would have some. It would deal with eminent domain. I would forbid the use of eminent domain
for economic development.
In fact, in the Kelo decision, the justices invited the states to pass eminent domain reform. Right. We did not. We passed a bill that was actually written by the California League of Cities. The people who like redevelopment and like eminent domain are the ones who wrote it. It was very modest.
So no eminent domain for blight?
Right.
But eminent domain for if you're going to build a road or public infrastructure?
I'm not challenging. Yep. I mean, my book on eminent domain doesn't deal with the genuine public use, even though it's sometimes misused.
Right.
But we understand a freeway or a railroad, even though that was abused, long ribbon of land, a courthouse, a school, we understand that's...
There does seem to be this trade-off, and I think I'm circling back to the same question, because I'm kind of sympathetic to this in the sense that when you read the Kelo case, it's just a nice old lady living in a house, and the Pfizer Corporation wants the property, and she won't sell. And so they take her house.
And look at it now.
Well,
look
now it's somebody, right. Now that's how it didn't work out, right. So the question is, if we talk about this in a racial justice way, or we talk about this in an empowerment of local communities, the part of your argument that appeals to me is, I want more tools in the local government toolbox. Like, I definitely think they need it. But how do we, and I maybe ask this three different ways, make the people making these decisions responsive to the actual needs and struggles of people? How do we keep them from abusing it? How do we keep them from focusing on the big developer and instead have the many small hands as part of this? And will that come through in a process of reform here?
Well,
I don't feel like that's the state's objectives.
The state doesn't care. And keep in mind, the conversation that we're having right now is a good academic discussion.
Yeah. Never gonna happen.
It would never happen because the argument that Steve makes, while I respect the debate and the discussion, we agree on a lot of this, it was not driven by eminent domain reform. The state could care less about that. Right. And that's why these reforms will never see the light of day, because they've taken themselves off of the table, because they don't. On the right, you have people who don't want eminent domain are saying it's just an evil. This is just evil government doing evil things.
Right.
Sacramento's not going to listen to that. On the left, what they're saying is, we want the money at the state level to pay for public employee unions, not give it to the locals to build their development projects.
Right.
That's where cities are stuck.
Right.
But they already gave all their money away to the public employee unions.
Well, you helped when you got rid of development, you gave an extra $1 billion a year. You did.
My point is this.
Yeah. What you have is you have local governments trying to use a tool that can be very powerful and used for social equity, including, I would argue, ownership in these projects.
Right.
I think that's the critical component.
It could be,
there should be a parameter and a regulatory framework set up to do that. When my property was taken, again, this is not academic, this happens to me. When that was taken from me, I was fully aware that I was not positioned with the knowledge base or the resources to build a 450, 500 unit project. But if I could have had an equity stake in that, would I have taken that all day long?
Right.
Why can't we create, this is just hypothetical, some sort of a framework that allows for that continued ownership for the people in those communities to perhaps not only live in those places where their homes are and or were, but participate financially in the public benefit that also accrues.
I want to give you a chance for a closing thought. I want to ask you this as part of going into that. One of the things that we say at Strong Towns often, and one of the things that I believe, is that the only real place where we have as citizens to work together collaboratively and do it effectively is at the local government level. And it could be at the block level or the neighborhood level, but really what a local government is or should be is us coming together to figure things out.
I disagree.
You disagree?
Yeah.
How
it's
do
like
we...
you guys have never heard of public choice theory.
No, I've definitely heard of public choice theory.
The government, I've been covering it for years, and I'm not saying I'm not an anarchist, although some days. Government officials operate out of their own set of self-interests. You give people power, they're going to abuse it. Now, I'm not saying there's not a role for government to enforce some easily understandable rules and different regulations. There's a role for government. But when you allow them to pick winners and losers and to play developer, you're really opening quite a can of worms. So you keep talking about giving government more tools. I want the government to have fewer tools, because the main tool the government has is a gun. I mean, I'm being facetious, but they can force us to do anything. So if I want to sell my property to the government at market price, I'll sell it if I want to sell it at market price. So at best, with eminent domain, they come in and they take your property, give you a market price, if you're lucky, and then you're not well off anymore. I mean, but the thing is, if it's for a public use, we understand that that's in the Constitution. But so that they can give your property to a developer who specializes in these things, it's terrible. And I've just seen what it's done, how it's obliterated cities, and it's obliterated downtowns. And sure, redevelopment helped the Gaslamp District in San Diego. It helped some of these streets here.
There are successes.
Yeah, I have a hard time believing, though, that downtown San Diego would not have improved itself without redevelopment. My argument is that let's allow people to do, the government should enforce some basic rules. Let's let people and investors do their own thing. And if they come up with an equity deal, come up with an equity deal. Government should mainly get out of the way.
Final thought, And let me ask you this question and kind of get you going. This idea of the system kind of being broken, or the feedback loops not being there,
right.
Prop 13, et cetera, all these spin-off effects. You seem to acknowledge that this is just overlaying another thing on top of that. Is this the best solution, or is this just the most pragmatic solution? I don't even want to use the word solution. Is this the best we can do right now, or is this just all we could do right now?
That's a great question. It's certainly the best we can do right now. Is it all we can do? No. Look, California, the housing problem, speaking specifically to housing, is so acute that it requires a dramatic increase in supply. Stephen's point is absolutely correct. But even if you got rid of CEQA tomorrow, you're not going to solve the housing crisis for 30 years. There has to be incentives. If you hold a value, a cultural value, that we should not live in a society of haves and have-nots. I fully respect those that don't care about that and say the rich should get richer and the poor should fend for themselves, and there's nothing wrong with that. That is a political philosophy. It's not one I subscribe to, but it is a legitimate one. And what I would say is this. Government has, I think, an obligation to do its best to provide for as many people as it can, given certain significant constraints. And with that, this tool, I think, is the best that we can do, given this Gordian knot of policy that we have created in California through a combination of ballot measures, bad public policy at the state level, and indiscretions at the local level.
We have gone long on this segment, which I thought was well worth our time. We've recorded this. This is going to be released as a podcast at strongtowns.org. If you're interested in downloading that in the future. And as I always say at the end of our podcast, thanks for listening and keep doing what you can to build strong towns. Stephen, welcome. Thank you very much. And thank you, Mike.
Thanks so much.
So nice to chat.
Appreciate it.
Please. Fantastic.